So this session is some research initiatives in the modeling of general insurance claim dependencies, presented by Greg, Yusuf and Bernard. I'll just give you maybe just a quick sort of intro just to the guys. I mean, Greg, everyone knows Greg, right? So it's pretty hard not to know Greg. Anyway, I mean, Greg worked for many years as a consulting actuary, most recently as a member of Tyler Fry. He's currently adjunct professor in the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies in New South Wales, University of New South Wales, Australia. Yusuf, I know Yusuf very well. He's executive manager, corporate actuarial at Suncorp. Yusuf has been working in the insurance general insurance industry for 14 years. He has experience in pricing across personal and commercial insurance lines. He has been involved in reserving projects, spanning most classes of business. More recently, his focus has been on internal capital modeling, natural hazards, and reinsurance strategy. And finally, Bernard Wong. Bernard is a senior lecturer in actuarial studies at the University of New South Wales. He's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and received his PhD from ANU, during which he also received the Fulbright Scholar Award. At the University of New South Wales, he chairs the School Research Committee and was previously the Director of Actuarial Programs. Bernard's teaching and research interests span three main areas: optimal asset allocation and asset liability management, optimal dividend and capitalization policy for risk business, the modeling of dependency in stochastic processes, as well as the interaction between all the different areas, right? So it's quite high profile. Anyway, I'll give to the guys briefly. I think, you know, I mean, it's probably good to sort of put some context to this. I mean, the collaboration between the GI industry and the University of New South Wales, I mean, has been in making for many, many years. I understand from David Coop that there have been multiple trips between city and the campus just to sort of understand exactly which are the sort of areas that will be of interest for the GI industry and University of New South Wales. Mike Sherris has been involved in all those conversations, and, you know, there's Bernard here, but there are a few other guys as well that has helped with the research and with the work. So I haven't seen any of the slides, so I can't really say, you know, what the guys are actually showing today, but I'm pretty sure there will be something interesting. Dependencies themselves, I mean, I think it's like the distribution of claims cost outcomes. It's a sort of holy grail in when you come to volatility modeling. I think dependencies between claims cost are pretty similar in a sort of similar space, or even more elusive. So guys, let's take it away.
Hey, thank you very much for that kind introduction. And somewhat, I didn't realize my bio was rather long. just as a note, this is joint work beyond just Yusuf, Greg, and myself. It's also David and Stephen sitting up the front there. And we'll just be talking today about very exciting project that we've started, and it's a multi-year project on claim dependencies. Quick outline for today. Yusuf and myself will give you an overview for what this project is about, in terms of the umbrella, what we call a linkage project, as well as the collaboration between industry and academia. And then Greg would also talk a bit about some observations he's found so far about dependencies. So the umbrella where this project falls under, it's what's called a linkage project, offered by the Australian Research Council. It's a competitive project, and it is collaborative between industry and academia. The aim of this project is to consider ways and means for enhancing the modelling of dependencies. Okay, so it's a fairly broad area, and there are lots of sub-projects that fall under this that we're working on. As I mentioned, it's a collaborative project, and so there are some partners. The idea behind linkage projects is to bring academia and industry together. On the academic side, we've got the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies at UNSW, for which Greg, myself, and also Benjamin, it's involved, and also University of Montreal, where Benjamin's currently at, so he's got joint position at UNSW in Montreal. The corporate partners are Allianz Insurance Australia Group and Suncorp, with corresponding representations, as you saw in the authors list. The funding for the project is partly funded by the Australian Research Council over 3 years. You can see the amount there. The partner organisations, being the corporate partners, the three companies, contribute a cash amount equal to roughly $88,000 there. For a project such as this, nominally the ARC and the partners contribute equal amounts, although the partners also contribute beyond cash in terms of expertise, in terms of data, contributions to the steering committee and so on. Okay, so and on top of that, of course, universities provide salaries for some of the chief investigators. So it's through academia, the research council, and the partner organisations. The project's managed by a steering committee. We've got various people working on various sub-projects, but we've got an oversight committee comprising of the three academic investigators, Greg, Benjamin, and myself, as well as representatives of the partners, which is generally Yusuf, David, and Stephen. We've got lots of sub-projects going on at different stages of completion. Listed some of them there, and Greg will talk a little about some findings that we have so far. And now I pass them to Yusuf.
Thanks, Bernard. So Bernard's given you basically the structure of the project and how it was formed, and Greg will talk about the results. But before handing over to Greg, I was asked to just make some comments from an industry perspective about this project and some observations. And from my perspective, I think that there's actually two interesting things about this project. The first one's obviously the topic that we're researching. The analysis of claim dependencies is a really hard problem. It's probably one of the hardest problems that we have in our industry, and it's remained a hard problem for a long period of time. It's also an important problem because it drives whether you're doing risk margins or capital modelling. It can have quite significant impacts on the results that you end up with. And while the actuarial profession has made some good progress on a conceptual front on thinking about this issue, the industry practice is still very highly judgmental and uncertain, and very difficult to justify the numbers that you've sort of come up with. So I think any progress that we make on this front will be very worthwhile. And Greg, and we're still at the infancy of this project. It goes for 3 years, so and the results so far are quite interesting. The second interesting thing about this project, I think, is the university and industry collaboration. And I think that's interesting because it sort of raises the issue around whether we as a profession and industry are making best use of the academic research capability that exists in our universities. And my own view is that we don't. And then that there will be significant benefit for the industry if there were more projects like this, and there was more closer coordination of the research efforts of the universities with industry needs. And I just had a go at trying to basically state what those benefits would be and some of the learnings that we came up with in this study. So the first benefit, I think, is that if industries more involved in the research agenda, we can influence the direction and alignment of the academic research. There is a lot of research that is done by the universities just in the normal course of their work. But one of the learnings from this project has been that if there's more interest from the industry, you can generate benefits that are more useful for the industry. And And the industry practitioners can bring in a perspective that is very useful to the academics as well, such as, you know, which problems are the most important, which problems are the ones where we have good enough solutions, and so further research wouldn't really add too much value, and also just what the current industry practice is in some of those problems. The second benefit of a closer collaboration, I think, is that it allows the industry to tap into the knowledge and expertise of the academic network. So a lot of us in industry do not have the time or perhaps the technical background to keep up with all the latest thinking that's happening in academia. And I think this closer collaboration allows the industry to tap into that network and bring in ideas and techniques which may be very useful for the industry. The third benefit of closer collaboration is that it allows the industry to actually accelerate the pace and quality of the research that's undertaken. Essentially, you have quite expert resources in the universities, both in terms of students and PhD students and researchers, which you can basically add to your research efforts, and that would be quite helpful for the industry. The fourth benefit, I think, of a project like this is that it allows the pooling of not only data from the industry, but also the expertise of the industry practitioners onto the one project, which can actually have a good impact on the way that the research is done. And some of that insight can also be very useful for the researchers in terms of the kind of things that they look into. And the final benefit, I think, is that some of the findings from research like this or another kind of research that we do can be quite controversial. And I think having this collaboration between a big segment of the industry and academia would mean that any findings that we come up with actually would be more useful, have greater credibility and more influence than each, whether it be industry or academia working alone. So I think that overall, I think that this is a very sort of useful project for the industry, and it's also a very promising way of doing future research between industry and academia, and I think that this is something that we should sort of pursue for other problems that are in the industry. So with that, I'll pass on to Greg.
Thanks, Yusuf. There's quite a bit of material here, but I'll start by assuring you that my tendency to skip will increase in proportion with the degree to which I see your lunch being compromised. Let's start at the beginning. One of the early thoughts that we had about this project, surprisingly it wasn't the first thought, but it did come reasonably early on, was that maybe it's a good idea to measure the extent of the problem before we begin trying to solve it. In other words, what sort of correlation is observed in practice? So I want to talk about the reason we're interested in this issue, talk a little bit about prediction error, some of the details of it, some comments on correlation, how this applies to insurance reserving, some numbers, and then some conclusions. So, the motivation first. Now, nothing new here. That formula tells us the motivation to which everyone here is working. This is a standard formula you can find in any statistics textbook. But one of the things that I want to emphasise in the next 15 minutes or so is that when we talk about correlation in this context, we always need to be careful to define exactly what we're talking about. So in this formula, we have two standard deviations and we have a correlation coefficient on the right-hand side. So let's be clear on what they are. And I'm talking here in a reserving context. It doesn't matter whether it's outstanding claims or premium liability. Either will fit into this framework. So the sigma is the mean square error of prediction of future claim cost and that particular sigma is for line of business J. And so that implies that the correlation coefficient is the correlation coefficient between future claim cost in one line of business and in another line of business. These are trivial observations, but sometimes the trivialities get lost in the discussion of the subject. Okay, so there's the need for correlations. We all know that. Just a small side comment. We all know that correlation is not the only way to measure dependency. And in fact, while I'll talk about correlation today, we have looked at other measures, but they don't make any difference in this context. We get essentially the same answers whichever measure of dependency we look at. But just some preliminary comments about prediction error, because these are relevant to the measurements we need to make. First, the proposition here. I mean, you actually hear this proposition sometimes. The correlation between lines I and J is X percent. Question, is that a meaningful statement? Well, let's take a look at it. And to do this, I want to look first at the structure of prediction error generally. So there's just a reminder of our basic formula, just to remind you of the quantities and their meanings. And here's another formula that everyone has scored into their brain somewhere. So here, sigma squared I denotes the prediction error for line of business I, and it's decomposed into its three well-known components. And I'd like to decompose it slightly further like this, so you can see that I've exploded the model error part into two components, one relating to the past and one relating to the future. And what do these mean? Well, the model error related to the past reflects any failures to model past data. In other words, you've fitted the wrong model. We all do it. We all know that we do it. We all know that it's inevitable. But it's a source of error in predictions. Whereas the future model error is something that would exist even if you had a perfect model of the past, because you've modelled the past. You haven't modelled the future. The future's still to come, and things may change. So let's reflect on these different components of error for a moment, and particularly in relation to two parallel lines of business. So lines I and J, subject to the same form of formula. Now, where would you expect correlation to occur? Would it occur in relation to process error? Well, no. I think there's general agreement that process error is just noise in the system, and generally there's no reason to expect that any dependency would arise between the two lines of business. What about parameter error? Well, no, again, because parameter error is something that derives from simply from using limited sample sizes. which causes an error to occur in parameter estimates. But there's no reason to expect that those errors would be correlated between lines of business, which leaves us with the model error. Let's think about the future model error first. Well, certainly this is the most fertile source of correlation. Just to take a very simple example, if you forecast inflation and future inflation turns out to be different from your forecast, then that is likely to affect different lines of business similarly. Immediately a correlation occurs. What about past model error? This one's not so clear. So question there, is there independence between lines of business or not? I'll leave that the answer to that open for a few moments, just while we consider that question further. But first, before doing that, let's just consider the situation where there is no correlation in past model error. So the only source of correlation is future model error. We'll just assume that. Well, I'll come back to this assumption in a moment. All right, here's an ugly formula for you, but it's only ugly because it has long subscripts. All that formula is saying is that the correlation between two lines of business now, by assumption, relates only to the correlation deriving from future model error, and then in the denominator we have a couple of standard deviations written out in a laborious form. The reason I've written them in that laborious form is that I just want to make a simple rearrangement of the formula now. And the point of the rearrangement is that you now see that the denominator consists of two factors, each of the form 1 plus something. And this leads us to the conclusion that the correlation between two lines of business, I and J, is actually less than the correlation that derives from future model error. And it might be slightly less, or it might be a great deal less, but that depends very much on the other terms in that expression. So it depends on the properties of the lines of business, and it also depends on the properties of the model the models you've used for those lines of business. Which brings us back to our question: is this proposition meaningful? And the answer is no. It's not meaningful on its own. You can't just go and say that commercial motor and private motor are 20% correlated. It all depends. It depends on a whole lot of other dispersion properties of those lines of business, but it also depends on how you've modelled them. Okay, let's come to some correlation basics now. I'm actually now going back to the question of whether past model errors are independent or not between lines of business. So let's consider whether they are or not. I want to start this by giving an example of a correlation. So here it is. I'm taking the correlation between per capita consumption of cheese in the US and the number of people who died by becoming tangled in their bed sheets, also in the US. Here are the data over the years 2000 to 2009. Very impressive. And if you calculate the correlation coefficient, you'll get 0.947. You'll actually get more than that. You'll get an automatic fail grade in time series 101. The flaw in the argument is obvious, that both series are subject to trends, and correlation isn't about measuring trends or relating one trend to another. So what correlation is concerned with is the association between two random variables. A trend isn't a random variable. So it's, you're concerned with dependent random variation within some model. And when you calculated that correlation coefficient, I was going to say you didn't have a model, but in fact you had a very trivial model, which was that the observations back in this plot were all just simple random variables. But they're not. It's much more reasonable to regard them as certainly random in some degree, but random perturbations about a fixed linear trend. And if you do that, correlation means that you correlate the residuals, that is the random variations about the trend. And in that case, the correlation coefficient reduces from 95% to 39%, of which all but 11% is explained by the last pair of observations. So what's the relevance of all this to insurance reserving? Well, actually, quite a powerful relevance. Because the conclusion we can draw from that silly little example is that if you have a poor model, you'll inflate past model error beyond what it needs to be. You'll also increase process error, probably, which is also bad, but that's not the point with which I'm currently concerned. And not only that, you may generate apparent correlations when none exist. In other words, if you have a good model, you'll find there are no correlations. You have a bad model, it appears that there are. And both of these things increase capital requirements. That's the punchline to this. So you end up with this sort of situation where the coefficients of variation that you estimate from your modelling, in the case of a good model, are the blue ones, and in the case of a bad model, are increased by the additional brown components. You see the process error increases, the past model error increases, and it's not clear to the naked eye, but the diversification credit decreases. Okay, well, it's always nice to look at some numbers, so let's look at that. I'll start off with the Bateup-Reed correlation matrix. I understand, of course, that not everyone uses this, but it still has a certain amount of influence in the industry. I'm guessing it has some influence on APRA, if no one else. And the circles here point to some quite high correlations of 75%. They're things I rarely see. And some I've marked some of 55%, but there are quite a few over 40 in that correlation matrix. Once again, I want to emphasise we have to be careful to define terms here. These correlations relate to what Bateup and Reed called systemic variance. Now, systemic variance means everything other than noise. So we're talking here about parameter error and model error. So we've gone and estimated some correlations across lines of business. We've used the Myers-Shee database that Julie referred to in the previous session. There's the the web address if anyone wants to follow that up. These are 10-year triangles. We've used the incremental loss triangles. And the data exists for six lines of business, which I've listed there. Now, we have detrended our data. The failure of time series 101 was that the candidate calculated correlations before detrending the data. So we have detrended the data, and we've done it by using a simple chain ladder. We don't regard that as the end of the story, and we're currently starting work on more refined models. But for only 10 by 10 triangles, the chain ladder will tell a reasonable proportion of the story. So what we've done then is for each pair of lines of business, and then for each company writing that pair of lines of business, we've taken the Pearson residuals relative to the chain ladder model, and we've correlated them between the lines of business. So we get one correlation for each pair of lines of business. We get one correlation per company, and there are a number of companies in the database. Again, let's be careful to say what it is we're measuring. This correlation relates to all past stochastic variation. So it captures our parameter error, our process error, and our past model error. It doesn't include future model error. And we have to remember that in these numbers, because future model error can be very significant. Okay, some results. So scatter plots of the correlations by company separately for each pair of lines of business. Here they are. So if you look at one of those vertical lines, each dot in it represents a company and plots the correlation coefficient measured for that company for that pair of lines. When you look at this plot, you ask yourself, am I just looking at a random sample of correlations around zero? You think, just eyeballing that, you think you can perhaps pick out some modest positive correlation, but it's not terribly compelling. We can test that. We construct PP plots. The heading's slightly misleading. It says PP plots of all correlations. It's actually Fisher transforms of the correlations. Fisher transforms map correlations onto the whole infinite line and are asymptotically normally distributed. So the purpose of these plots is to test whether the observed correlations their Fisher transforms are normally distributed around zero. The bulging of the red dots above the blue line indicates positive correlation. If they were perfectly normally distributed, the red dots would coincide with the blue line. And so what you see here for private passenger auto and commercial auto is some modest positive correlation. For workers' comp and other liability, really nothing. And then the final thing that we might do is to take the for each pair of lines of business, we might take the arithmetic average of the correlations we observe over the different companies. And if we do that, we get those results. Quite low correlations. One or two of them might squeeze through a significance test as not being zero, but they're generally low. So, conclusions. I've tried to emphasise, as I've gone through this, that whenever we talk about this subject, we need to define carefully the terms of the terms we're addressing. Second, the data must be detrended before you begin measuring correlations. If it's not, you're just not measuring correlation. And the third point is that the current received wisdom, as I know it, is that there are some large correlations between lines of business. This case is not proved. To the extent that I've seen evidence, the evidence is to the contrary. But I'm not here to make an assertion of that. I'm simply saying that there's limited evidence. It doesn't support the case of large correlations, but there's more work needed, and we hope to carry out some of that work over the remaining 2 years of our project. Thanks very much.
Are there any questions? Probably have time for one or two questions in the session.
Hugh Miller, Ella Fry. One result that I've read in finance is that when they tried to measure correlations between asset classes in sort of relatively benign times, those correlation numbers come out quite low. But in sort of extreme market movements, they actually all tend to end up quite high. I was wondering whether that was something you thought about for insuring.
Thought about it to at least a limited extent. In that, I should have said this when I was speaking, no one should get too excited about those very low correlations, because I did point out that they exclude future model error. And there's no doubt that future model error would build up those correlations quite a bit. So I don't want to over-egg the pudding in this argument, but simply to point out that as far as we can make measurements on available data, the correlations we find are low. As to your specific question, I don't know. I mean, it's US data. We're going to work with Australian data. For the moment, it's US data. It covers the period 1988 to 1997. Whether that was a period of upheaval in the US, I don't know. I mean, I guess it includes the US liability crisis, so there is that destabilising event. But beyond that, I'm not really sure. I think that if unstable times are encountered, then that would add a lot to the future model error that I talked about, and build up correlations in the way that you imply that you might be expecting.
Any more questions?
How exciting. Stephen Britt, by the way. First of all, Annette, this is really interesting stuff, and we'll need to make sure that we get the most out of this research by contributing data or ideas. Quick question. You say data must be detrended. Yes, it should. It must be. But understanding what the trend is important in our line of work. We would probably, as actuaries, think about that as the exposure, the number of cars on the road. But it may be that the source of the trend is itself a random variable, which should be in your future model and will contribute significantly or not to future correlation in model error. You want to talk to that?
I don't know that I've got much to say other than I agree with your suggestion. I guess the only real address of future model error that I'm aware of is the work by O'Dowd et al. From about 10 years ago that's found currency in one or more of the insurers. And that really is the thrust of that work. It's to say, well, take a look at all the things that go into the model, and this one might vary, this one might vary, and so on. And that is really doing what you're asking, I think. And yeah, I agree, it should be there.
Right. I think is there one more question?
Joseph Wang from Avant. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you think the outcome might be if you applied this work across perils within one line of business. As in, would you find a very low correlation across perils within, say, fire?
It would be pure speculation to answer. It's an interesting question, though, because it's a question that has arisen amongst ourselves. That is, yes, you can look at lines of business, and it's highly relevant to do that because that's what APRA does. But there are other segments that may be of interest internally. I mean, for example, if you're an insurance company, within the same line of business, you may be interested in intermediated business versus internet business, for example. That's correlation right there. But yeah, as to yes or no, I can't talk. I don't know. We haven't looked at that.
All right, so I think we're going to probably close this off. So if you could please join me to thank the guys for the